Coming up today, fighting ISIS with AI, the numbers behind the latest cryptocurrency hacking trend, and we explain why PUBG is the perfect game for noobs. You're listening to episode 356 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hi.
Facts.
Me. I'm
yes,
gonna go
you.
First. The Metropolitan Police, London's and the UK's biggest police force, has a 10-year supply of fuel stored in case there is a fuel crisis or emergency or everything turns into sort of a dystopian anarchy.
Wow.
Well, it's good to be prepared.
It is. They're actually looking to sort of maybe change how much they store in the future because they're going to more electric vehicles and potentially hydrogen vehicles in the future as well. Which
so
is
they might
how
have batteries
it.
Rather than fuel.
I don't know that
potentially.
Much. But.
So do they also have like 10 years of water, 10 years of food?
I don't think so. Probably not, which is maybe a bit of a
I suppose
a
they
problem.
Could drive to...
Yeah, they just drive to Tesco's and raid it.
Yeah,
it'll
and nobody
fine.
Else will be able to get to Tesco.
Exactly, because it would have been the apocalypse. Well, it's very good to be prepared. Vicky Turk.
I have a horrifying fact. So this is the amount of prey in weight eaten by the global spider population every year. It is 400 to 800 million tons. So that's 400 to 800 million tons worth of... insects, mollusks, vegetation, other spiders that
right.
spiders eat every year.
So put that in context. What is that in terms of something I can understand?
So that's like 2 to 4 million blue whales.
Right.
Wow.
That is a tremendous amount. How many spiders
are
there?
I double and triple checked this because I just couldn't believe it. It's in a scientific paper. Look it up. You will find it. I know. It's
absolutely
terrifying.
Incredible. Yep. Well, way to go, spiders. You look horrified, man.
Yeah, I'm just also wondering how many tons of spiders humans eat in a year.
Next week, bring that fact if you can find it. I'm sure there must be like an average number of insects ingested inadvertently by humans every year. And we could probably... We'll do the maths and see if we can work that one out for you.
We won't do the maths.
No, we won't. But you never know. Tune in to find out. I learned this week that for the first time in 20 years, fewer people are riding the London Underground than in the previous year. So growth has gone down rather than up. So with 20 million fewer journeys made across the year, so that's equivalent to around 4 million fewer passengers in the year up until last November, which is 4 solid days of normal tube operation. And the weird thing is, no one really knows why, because London's population keeps going up. So more people should be on the tube, but they're not.
So one reason for this is potentially that kind of lifestyles are changing, right? So more
yes.
people working from home, less people doing the daily commute slog into central London.
So there's a number of possibilities as to why this is happening. Maybe more people are taking the bus, or more people are cycling, or more people are taking Ubers late at night when they ordinarily would have caught the last train home or last tube home. People are ordering delivery rather than going out for dinner and watching Netflix rather than going to the cinema. So maybe taking all those things in aggregate, it can have a fairly massive impact on the number of people who are using the tube, which is bad news for TfL, Transport for London, the body that operates the network, because it means that they're losing money and they need the money to make the improvements to make the network better. So it's kind of a bit of a catch-22, if that's... No, it's not. It's not a catch-22 at all. It's just a pain.
The tube's busy enough, though.
Exactly. Yeah, apart from this week, it's half term, which means it's just about busy enough.
Oh, is that why?
Yes.
I can actually get on the train
yes.
in the morning.
Yes, all the families have fled London. Right, so we will start, as we always do, with our first story, which is about ISIS. This week, the government announced a new AI-based detection tool for removing ISIS videos from the web before they can spread widely. It's been worked on by the London-based machine learning firm ASI and cost the government £600,000. They announced it this week with no partners.
Oh, that's a good start then.
Yes.
So what does that mean? No one is using the tool?
No one is using the government's new £600,000 state-of-the-art AI-based machine learning system for removing extremist videos from the internet, yes. Which is an extraordinary thing to announce, really.
I thought you would get some partners signed up before you announced it.
I wonder if they were quite hasty. So the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, was visiting Silicon Valley this week to have talks with her sort of contemporaries in the American administration, and they potentially wanted this big announcement to be ready. The company ASI that was working on it started working on it last September, so it's probably a case of rushing to get it finished. Or not rushing, but, you know, they just got it finished in time to make this announcement. And the wonky thing that they've forgotten to do was announce any partners, which kind of at the moment makes it a completely pointless way to spend £600,000. But that there is potential.
Yeah, so when if they get some partners, and assuming they probably will, what's it actually going to do?
So there was a time not too long ago when the British government and the American administration and lots of governments around the world were really concerned about the spread of extremist propaganda on Facebook and Twitter and particularly YouTube. And all of those big networks, in fairness to them, spent a lot of time and effort clamping down on it. So they developed AI-based systems for detecting and removing this stuff at source. So what the government has done with ASI is it's handed it a list of 1,300 videos that it sees as particularly dangerous for radicalization by ISIS. And it said to them, develop a machine learning system that can spot these videos and videos that are very like it. Facebook, Google, and Twitter can already do this. They've developed that kind of technology in-house, and potentially Microsoft as well. But the problem is, it's very valuable intellectual property, so they're unwilling to share it, seemingly, or the government presumably wouldn't have gone on its own and done this, which is kind of an unprecedented thing for a nation state to do, or at least for a democracy to do. So it's developed this tool for smaller sites to use it, and research that the government points to found that 400 different sites were used by ISIS to host propaganda in 2017 alone, and 100 plus of those were used in the last couple of months of 2017. So it's a bit of a whack-a-mole game.
It is. And for a little bit more context on that, I've actually got some figures for you on the use on Facebook and Twitter. So Facebook in November 2017 said 99% of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, the government's system is only for Islamic State technology at the moment. Facebook system could detect 99% of these. And because of the way that it works in identifying similar images and things like that across the content, it can flag these before they're actually posted online, which is the point of the government system as well. Yeah. And Twitter said in the first 6 months of 2017, it took down 300,000 terrorist accounts, and most of these were automated. And that's the same way as Facebook and the sort of plan here. So the system does and can work, but it's more a case of the government is sort of saying we should be involved in this.
Yeah, what it really needed to do, this for me is a good thing, and for people that work in this field of research of radicalization and the spread of online propaganda, see it as broadly a good thing. But they have to have partners for this kind of system. You can't announce and make a big song and dance, pre-brief all the national press about it, and then someone goes, so who have you partnered with? And, well, no one yet, but we hope that other people in the industry will get on board. Well, I'm sure they might, but they also might not. They might not want to be working with the government on these kind of systems, even if they are being provided by the Home Office gratis. So the Home Office is going to give this technology away to any partners that it deems fit and proper to use them. And what's quite interesting is I was speaking to Charlie Winter, who's an expert in radicalization, particularly on ISIS propaganda. And he was explaining that ISIS was a particularly easy target for machine learning systems because it's so obsessed with branding. So ISIS's centrally and provincially produced media operations all adhere to certain brand guidelines. They use set music, logos, iconography, editing techniques. They look and feel the same. They have a strong brand identity. So you can easily train a machine learning algorithm on the aspects of that brand identity. And this is him speculating. ASI and the Home Office refuse to disclose how the system is automatically detecting ISIS propaganda. But that's the idea, that it's going after these slick, highly produced videos that are put out centrally by ISIS rather than shaky iPhone footage.
So like a hypothetical example could be, you know, maybe the machine learning algorithm has been trained to pick up an ISIS flag.
Yep. Yeah,
so
a flag
any video
or
with a flag, it might flag as
It might flag. Yeah. And according to Charlie Winter again, the music is particularly what's the right word? It's on all the videos, the same kind of
consistent
music library, consistent across the videos. So it's quite easy to spot these videos. And the counter to that is, oh, well, couldn't ISIS just pivot to slightly different branding? And chances are it might. But over time, the machine learning system, which learns as it goes along, will get better at spotting these. And I'm sure this is a similar thing that Facebook and Google and Twitter have seen in their automated systems. They have to develop and adapt over time as the target develops and adapts over time. But my question to you is, should a government be doing this? Is this the role of the state when sort of the free and open internet fails to tackle this issue?
Do you want to go first, Vicky?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's an interesting question. Sorry, that's a big non-answer, isn't it? I do feel like it's maybe something that government and tech companies should be working on together because, you know, yes, this stuff is available on the tech companies' platforms and therefore it is their responsibility, but it is also a political question. And some of these calls, I don't think you necessarily want tech companies to have the power of deciding what should be censored and what shouldn't.
Yeah.
I think that is a political question as well. So I think, yes, they have a role in this, but I think it would work best if they are working in cooperation with the big tech platforms.
I'm going to agree, but also try to disagree to make it a bit more interesting and say no.
You're going to play devil's advocate.
I am. But no, government shouldn't be that involved in this. Yes, on the sort of conversational level, but in terms of developing the technology and working with a company to develop it in terms of the specifics of providing material and actually being like involved in probably some of the decision-making process, I think they shouldn't, because the next version of this system that they produce for IS will focus for Al-Qaeda propaganda.
Yeah.
And then what comes next? That's my big sort of worry. Like, what does the government, when does it stop sort of saying, we're getting involved in this? When does it become into political propaganda that the systems is trained to look at? And sort of the influence there just can grow and grow. So I think that they should be involved in the discussions, but in terms of like the implementation and sort of what the capabilities are, that should probably be something that the state isn't involved in. Obviously, there's the other question of big tech companies policing themselves. Which is difficult.
I suppose that's a point. The government should be involved in the regulatory side, which is its job, and the tech platforms should be involved in the tech side, which is their job.
Yeah.
But maybe the government can offer some kind of best practices or
Yes. So
guidelines.
This seems like a very sensible suggestion. As a government, as the Home Office, which has very definite expertise in the area of radicalization, whether it's tackling it successfully or not is another question, it has deemed these videos to be especially potentially dangerous. And this is something that experts in the field of radicalization agree with. These videos are hugely dangerous. So it's got that expertise, but it needs to be quite open about the guidelines that it's developing around those as to how and what it deems to be something that's worth censoring, that needs to be censored. So you have the problem of, well, you don't want private companies to be doing it because, well, that's a bad idea, but you don't want the state to be doing it because effectively, if you boil it down, and I sort of alluded to this earlier, it's unprecedented for a democracy, but you go to China and there are AI-powered state censorship tools running amok to shut down discussions on Chinese social media about everything from freedom in Hong Kong to the Tiananmen Square protests.
And this is only really, at its simplest level, a few steps away from that.
Yeah.
And if another government were to do this or something similar, or the UK government were to give this to, I don't know, another regime that is maybe more oppressive, there's no reason why they couldn't adapt that system to their own purposes.
Yeah, it needs to be very, very carefully regulated and very, very open as much as it can be, so it can be held to account by people with expertise and relevant scrutiny in these areas. But crucially, it needs people to use it.
Yeah, and I think that there's a few other issues around sort of this piece of technology that's particularly been developed around the transparency side of things, especially which makes it a bit more murky in my eyes when a government has been involved, because they're talking about sort of there's loads of percentages put out on this. They said it can detect like 94% and or has like a 0.005 false positive error or something like that. And there's no sort of evidence to back this up. It's more just the government has said, oh, our system can do this, it's wonderful, it will get it right 99% of the time, but it hasn't published any sort of an academic paper would be much better to say this is how the system works, this is what we've trained it on.
It's actually 99.995% of the time, I think. This is interesting. So that, again, ASI, the company behind it, I was speaking to them about this issue of false positives. So to explain, a false positive in this sense is when the AI system incorrectly identifies a video that it shouldn't censor and censors it.
It thinks it's terrorist, but it's not.
Yeah. And then on the flip of that, you have terrorist videos that it doesn't spot and get through. And there's a compromise that you have to play between how many false positives do you want and how many do you reasonably want to let slip through. So on a platform like YouTube, where there are something like 5 million videos uploaded every day, at the false positive rate of 0.005% that this system operates at, that lets through about 250 videos a day that a human reviewer is going to have to sit there and just check, which is deemed to be kind of a reasonable burden to place on a platform. So the technology allegedly is more accurate, but they have to make it less accurate in order to make it implementable by technology platforms. But once again, no technology platforms are using it. And that really is something that the government needs to get sorted very, very quickly. Otherwise, it spent £600,000 maybe learning a bit, but not actually doing anything actionable. And that would be a terrible mess to find ourselves in.
It would. That money could have went to working with technology platforms on a better system or just, yeah, lots of other better things.
On something a bit more collaborative with some of these big networks who are presumably pumped an awful lot more time and resource into it. But it's certainly an interesting initiative by the British government. They're taking a bit of a risk on going out alone on this. And we'll see what comes of it. And we'll be very interested to see who, if anyone, is the first partner to sign up to this platform. Story number two, PUBG. Vicky, you insisted that you bring this wretched game onto the podcast.
Wretched game? What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, I have never played it. I've just read lots of hot takes about it.
So James and Matt are fed up of hearing me talk about PUBG, Player Unknown's Battlegrounds, in the office because I love this game. And so I wrote a piece about it recently, just basically explaining my passion for this game.
Let's put this in context. You love this game.
I love this game.
What other games do you love?
This is pretty much the only thing I play.
Exactly.
Except
this
for
is
Zelda on the Switch. So this was my my thesis. Is basically, I had never played a PC game before. I had zero interest in first-person shooters, which PUBG is. And I just got hooked on PUBG and I love it and I play it and it has turned me into a gamer.
And as PC games go, this is about as PC-y game as PC games get.
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily think it's kind of the most appropriate for a beginner, I suppose. But actually, I think it is. So, I mean, for anyone who hasn't heard of PUBG...
This is me. Because for the last 2 weeks, I've been thinking you were saying punchy in the office and that it was a game about boxing, which isn't. So,
no, it's
enlighten
not. It's,
me.
Tremendous.
So, it's a battle royale style survival game on PC and Xbox. And basically, you play with up to 100 people. You get dropped from a plane onto this island and you have to run around and loot for weapons, armor, and other kind of helpful items. And then it's just a battle to the death. And the last one standing wins. So you're basically just running around, hiding, shooting, hoping to be the last person alive.
Yeah. And a lot of that in itself isn't particularly revolutionary. Like, it's borrowing lots of elements from games that have been around forever. But the thing that really makes this game different and means that I'll never want to play it because it would stress me out is that there's a circle around the map, right, that gets smaller and smaller and smaller.
So basically, as you start playing, the play zone gets smaller and smaller throughout the game. A circle kind of appears on the map. You don't know where it's going to be. It's different every time. And if you stay outside it for too long, you start taking damage and ultimately you will die. So it kind of forces you as the game progresses to get into this tighter and tighter play zone. And, you know, a game, if you're in it till the end, which I have never been, can last up to a maximum of kind of 30 minutes.
Yeah, as someone who likes just climbing big hills on Zelda to have some peace and quiet, this sounds like an absolute nightmare for me.
I mean, I have climbed a few hills in PUBG when I've got a decent sniper rifle, picking people off in the distance.
Right.
How close have you got to winning?
Ah.
So I've never won, but the best I've come actually is third.
And out of 100.
Out of 100, yeah. And wow. this was some real beginner's luck because that was, I think, the second time I've ever played. And I literally had never done the kind of WASD direction controls on the keyboard before. So I was still really learning. But this is one reason why I think this game is perfect for beginners.
Hiding
is a perfectly good strategy. And actually, camping, which is frowned upon in most games, that's when you kind of hole up in a room somewhere just waiting for someone to find you so you can shoot them.
Yep.
That is a perfectly fine thing to do. It's a good tactic. So for a beginner, if you want to lay low, don't try and attack anyone. Don't give away your position. Yeah. And if you're a bit lucky with how the circle falls, you can kind of crawl around. I hid in some long grass and make it very close to the end.
So I think a lot of our listeners will be very familiar with this game, or certainly familiar with the phenomenon of this game. But what was interesting about your experience with it was that you barely play games. So you played a little bit of Zelda, you got a little bit into the Switch, and then you immediately went to one of the most, like, not hardcore, but like fairly gamey games.
It's just so compulsive. So I watched a friend play it. And it gets really tense, you know, when you get to those final moments and there's fewer and fewer people left and you're kind of in a house with a shotgun and you're wondering if there's someone outside and you know you have to make a break for it soon because the circle's closing in. It really gets very sort of intense. You feel like you're in kind of the climactic scene of a movie. And then, you know, you get shot, you die, and it all starts over again. And that's one of my favourite things about it. As a newbie, I could play this game and, I might get killed almost instantly, but you just sort of refresh every time.
So as a newbie, do you get the impression that you're surrounded by a sea of angry American teenagers? Or are there fellow newbies who are on here enjoying the game in a different way?
So I always kind of thought that everyone else was a lot better than me. And that I was the only one who kept kind of, you know, driving off cliffs or, you know, accidentally forgetting to reload my gun and things like that. But one thing I really like is recently they introduced a replay feature, which means that you can watch a game back and you can see other players within a certain radius of yourself, your own character. And you can see what they're doing. And it's a really good insight into how other people play. Mm. And one thing I really like about it is you can see that there are other people just hiding or like, doing God, you're like, why are you still near that tree? What are you doing? Or, you know, dying outside the play zone.
So you can laugh at them and their
pratfalls. And so it's a bit heartening that you realize you're not the only one who's making these mistakes.
And this is the other big driver behind its success, right? It's absolutely rife to be turned into a major esport, to be huge on Twitch and YouTube streams.
It's really popular on Twitch. I mean, just to put this in perspective, how popular this game is. I've got some stats which are from the 8 months during which the game was in early access mode, which it was until December on Steam. And in just that time, when it was still early access, it sold 26 million copies and over 2.7 billion hours were played.
Wow.
With a peak of 3.1 million concurrent players. And this is huge. It's very big in China.
Mm-hmm.
Tencent has bought the rights to the game in China.
But it's banned in China,
a mobile game. No, I don't think it is, actually.
Okay.
So Tencent has bought the rights, so they will make a Chinese version.
Yep.
And they're working on a mobile game as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's technically banned.
Okay.
There's certainly a lot of Chinese players.
Yeah. And it's on the verge of probably breaking through as a major esport.
Well, yes. I mean, I actually spoke to Brendan Green, who is player unknown, and he is very keen. You know, that's his ultimate goal, is to turn this into an esport.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it's still really buggy. Like, there's a lot of problems that need to be fixed before that can happen.
Yeah.
You can still die because the game physics go weird.
But if you're a major publisher, the likes of Electronic Arts or Microsoft or Sony Studios or Ubisoft, you must be looking at this thing that's been developed essentially by a load of people in their spare time or just one guy?
Well, no, so the story is, so Brendan Green, he used to make mods for, I think it was Arma 2, which basically put this Battle Royale style spin on these other popular games. And then Bluehole Studios, which is a Korean game studio, saw these and invited him to come and make an actual Battle Royale game.
Oh, right.
So they brought him over to Korea, and that's where they're working on it. And they've now spun out the company as PUBG Corporation.
Huh.
As a subsidiary. As
this is the kind of success that the big game development studios absolutely dream of and spend tens of millions of dollars trying to achieve, and invariably don't. What is it? If you could boil it down to one thing, why is this the game that's got you gaming? Why is this the game that's been played for 2.7 billion hours?
Do you know, I think the secret to it is it's really simple in kind of the basic play mechanics and the kind of idea of the game. It's very simple to grasp, so you can start playing pretty immediately. But there's always an element of chance.
Yep.
So if you kind of do badly one round, you might have good luck the next. You know, you might just stumble across some really good loot, or you might just happen to be in the circle and be able to get a really good position. So it's different every time. And, you know, there's always, you, however good or bad you are, you can always maybe get lucky. And as you go, you know, even though the fundamental gameplay is pretty straightforward, there are various things that just make it that just add a different level of complexity. So as you play more and more, you get more and more used to the different weapons and what they're capable of. And there's things called drops, which is when an airplane drops a kind of care package onto the map. Again, mm-hmm. that can fall totally randomly, and they have even better loot in them, so you can kind of dash for those and hope to get like a really badass sniper rifle. Yeah, and there's loads of different strategies you can try. So if you watch on Twitch, people obviously trying to put on a good show tend to be very aggressive, go for lots of kills. You can also, as I said, you know, just kind of hide around and try and sneak into that last circle.
So the original pitch for this story when Vicky was writing her op-ed for the website, I think, was just Vicky loves PUBG. I think from the last 10 minutes, we've made that abundantly clear.
Yeah, I just, you know, I am not a PUBG shill. I just wanted to share my passion.
After having heard you talk about it, I actually think that I would be interested in watching an eSport with 100 people in one room, all playing this game at once. It's sort of editorially produced on a big screen in terms of, like, the same way as a football match would be.
Yeah.
That actually sounds cool, yeah. Interesting. And, like, if everybody's lit up and then when they die, their light goes out and you can't see them. And then at the end of the match or whatever, there's like 10 people that are just sort of left lit up around this room of computers.
Yep. Yeah.
That could be quite tense as, like, an audience part.
So you can also play as squads. So you have, like, a team of four people, which I imagine in esports would be popular. And I think it's a really interesting prospect as an esport because you are rewarded for playing safe.
Yep.
So I don't know if they would change that a bit, maybe in an esport version, or if
introduce
it would
different
still be
modes.
Yeah, because especially
kind of
as there are fewer people around, you basically want to hold your fire so as not to give away your position.
Yeah.
So it becomes a lot less about kind of raw skill and ability to aim and things like that, and more about strategy and you know, kind of operating on that sort of intellectual level, I suppose, of deciding when to move and when to stay.
This whole thing just completely stresses me out. The thought of spending my evening reenacting Battle Royale.
I am
going to
get you over sometime, play a game of PUBG, and you will be hooked.
I will be on the Switch climbing mountains in Zelda just for the peace and quiet and the sound of the breeze. Third story, crypto hacking. Cryptocurrencies we're familiar with. Crypto hacking, Matt Burgess, what is this?
Okay, so this week there were 4,000 websites in the UK, the US, Australia, loads of other countries around the world that had a crypto miner found on them. So in the UK, there was the Manchester City Council, the ICO, which is the data protection regulator, the US court system over there, and basically a plugin that all of these websites use called Browser Loud and produced by a British company called TextHelp, and reads out sort of things that are on screen and helps people with who haven't got English as a first language.
Yeah.
This plugin was compromised at its source, and it added the people who did this added crypto mining code to that plugin, so it appeared on all of these websites basically at once.
This is a stroke of absolute criminal genius and a major scandal, right? Is it? It isn't, though, is it?
No, not really. So, like, third-party plugins and things like that have been hacked for a long time. There's been lots of people that have sort of replaced this sort of thing, but this is probably the first big time where a crypto miner has been put onto this, onto websites on a mass scale. So the way that it worked was this crypto miner was mining the Monero cryptocurrency.
What is Monero?
I
That's
couldn't
not
tell
Bitcoin,
you.
Right?
It's an open source cryptocurrency.
It's worth about
$273.
It's just another cryptocurrency. Let's just say that for the sake of it. This was injected onto all these websites. So when people open these websites, so if you're looking at what time your bin will be collected in Manchester that next week, you would be mining this cryptocurrency.
As you do.
So somebody, whoever created it, was trying to make money from actually doing this.
And the grand total of compromising 4,000 websites around the world for pretty much a day.
It was 4 hours.
4 hours? Okay, yeah. Well, that's long enough. How much did they make?
They made a grand total of, wait for it, $24.
I mean, that is the big bucks.
That is like the biggest of the bucks, really. But it's just...
It's a proof of concept, right?
Yeah.
That's what they were doing.
This is really what it has to be, because if you were doing this, you wouldn't have been looking to make that much money because it was a pretty well-known plugin, lots of really well-known websites, and this sort of thing actually got flagged by somebody's antivirus. So this is an easy way to see it. But
yeah.
It's showing that you can actually mine cryptocurrency across thousands of websites at one time, and you may be able to develop something that is slightly more sophisticated in future.
And could hide. Yeah.
Does this damage your computer at all? Like, if you have been using these websites and you use this plugin and you're maybe worried that you were one of those people who was inadvertently helping to mine Monero, is that a bad thing? Should you be doing something?
So there's not really, as far as I'm aware, any sort of long-term impacts on this. So the crypto mining would only happen. You would only be creating cryptocurrencies when you had the browser open. And when you closed it and closed the website, you wouldn't be doing it anymore. While you were doing it, though, that's where the sort of more of an issue comes in, because this script in particular was programmed to use 60% of a person's CPU, so the processing power. So your computer would have instantly slowed down by 60%, let's say.
You would have noticed a difference in performance, but crucially, the difference between using 60 and, say, 70, 80, 90, 100% of someone's spare CPU is that you wouldn't notice, really.
No, if they were using 100%, which some crypto miners and stuff have done, it would just completely...
Stop you
your
from
PC
doing anything
from
else,
working
right?
at all, and
yep.
it would take probably about 5 minutes to move the mouse to the close close button in the corner. So
yep.
it's not the sort of worst case, but I think there are sort of bigger issues around. This could have actually been a lot worse in some cases if you just look at the sort of the security of the plugin itself. If they'd sort of taken the older approach of introducing malware or looking or stealing people's data from just some sort of script that did that rather than Bitcoin mining, or not Bitcoin, cryptocurrency mining, it could have been a lot worse. So on the plugin level, it should have been better, but this is just sort of a new proof of concept of a vulnerability.
And it could be something that we see an awful lot more of if people are able to develop more sophisticated versions of this that fly under antivirus detection and are able to run for a long time on many more sites. Even at a very low CPU usage, you could potentially at scale make a lot of money?
You could, but you would have to have it running on a lot of websites and be on a lot of people's computers and have a lot of traffic through to those websites as well.
And I guess that because of the way that cryptocurrencies work, sorry, butting in, is people would notice wallets suddenly swelling in size as one person started hoovering up all of the cryptocurrency on whatever... chain it might be.
Yeah, that's definitely a possibility, but it depends on if anybody's keeping an eye on individual wallets that are created, which is probably fairly unlikely. But one of the interesting things about this, I think, is just how much these sort of these things are starting to pop up, because there is crypto miners on so many websites at the moment. And some of the people I was speaking to for our story on this were saying that actually they've seen a real drop in the amount of ransomware within the last 6 months, which is probably linked to the inflation in price in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, because a lot of ransomware software demands that people pay one Bitcoin or two Bitcoin. And when one Bitcoin was worth $20, that's not a huge issue. But when one Bitcoin's worth $15,000, you're less likely to get any sort of money back.
Pay 0.0002 Bitcoins to unlock your computer.
And actually a lot, and somebody from Malwarebytes, the sort of malware analyst company, was saying that a lot of the ransomware software is actually quite difficult to change. So unless you know the code inside out and stuff like that, you can't really change even just like the values of things within the code, because it's complex and people can buy this sort of thing off the shelf. So it's actually, this crypto mining is probably partly in rise due to the rise in the amount of value within cryptocurrencies generally.
I've seen another story a bit like this, right? So this is not just kind of naughty malware plugins or whatever. Because I saw going around Twitter that a news website has been asking people to mine cryptocurrency in order to use their website, right?
Yeah, so actually there are legitimate uses for crypto mining. It depends on what your definition of legitimate is.
Let's do big air quotes around legitimate there, please.
But Salon in the US, which is a news and sort of popular culture website has said this week that if you're using an ad blocker, you either have to turn it off or you can allow the browser to be crypto mining. And it's the same system. It's the Monero crypto mining currency. So they're using that, or potentially trying to use it, as a way for them to make money that they would have been making through people viewing their adverts on their website.
Yes.
And the Pirate Bay in the past has used crypto mining script on its website as a source, a potential source of revenue.
So in the case of Salon, are they saying that the amount of processor power that they would have used to serve you adverts is then used to mine cryptocurrency, that it stays equivalent? Is that the idea?
I don't think so.
You could kind of see that
I mean, surely
might
that wouldn't be enough.
Well, spread over enough people, you might make like a little bit of money, and the amount of money that you make from display advertising is quite low and relies on it working at scale, right? That's, as working in publishing, we know this to be true. But I can't imagine them doing that. That would make sense. But what they are doing then, you'd imagine, is they're using people's spare processor power above and beyond what you would use by visiting that site, even if you were seeing ads. So they're effectively thrashing people's computers, which will eventually wear them out. Like, there is a physical cost to a computer being used and used and used and used, that they get old and they die in a way, unless you keep them refurbished or whatever.
Unless you water them and blanket over them.
Exactly, yeah, and read them stories at night. And they're also using a huge amount of power.
That's the other thing, isn't it?
In an era when we're all being told, you know, be careful with how much you're using electronics, and, you know, be mindful of climate change, because it's a really, really important issue that we need to tackle. As a publisher, surely you can't sit down and go, I know, we'll contribute towards global warming by forcing people to mine cryptocurrency if they don't want to see our ads. This is stupid.
It is a bit stupid. And when you look at the sort of the value that was created just from 4 hours, the $24, from 4,000 websites,
yeah,
which will combined have an infinitely higher amount of click-throughs and people visiting them than Salon, as
yeah,
much as I'm sure
you'd
it
imagine,
has a
yeah,
good amount. It's not going to make them much money either. So
no.
I don't know if it's a publicity stunt or something, but it just seems a little bit
quite a bad
silly
publicity stunt. Even in the world of online publishing, there is better money to be made than $24 for 4 hours of ownership of 4,000 different domains around the world. That is, you know, you can do better than that.
It also does seem a little bit underhand, perhaps. Like, I imagine many
yes,
Salon readers probably don't really understand what cryptocurrency mining is, or what it
no,
involves, or what it means.
It's just dodgy. And there were two other stories recently that are related to this. The BBC published a story about how SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Alien Intelligence, can't get hold of enough GPUs. Because everyone's...
This is a big problem, yeah. I've been trying to build a gaming PC so I can play more PUBG.
Oh, yeah?
I'm currently sharing my partners.
And they're too expensive.
They are quite... They've gone up in price.
Yeah, so there's so much demand for GPUs at the moment that SETI can't get enough of them in. It's more not just the price, but it's the availability of them. They're always out of stock all over the place because they're all being hoovered up by Bitcoin mines or cryptocurrency mines. And related to that, Iceland, which is one of the world's largest centres for cryptocurrency mining, is now on the verge of the entire country's normal energy consumption being matched by the country's cryptocurrency mining energy consumption.
That's just silly.
And Iceland's very small. You know,
it
it's 300,000 people, I think, which is about the population of Coventry. But still,
they don't need to be using 600,000 people's worth of electricity just because they're mining Bitcoin.
It's a little silly, isn't it? Although Iceland generates most of its electricity geothermally, so it's quite clean, but still, definitely better ways to be using all of that electricity. And it's somewhat against the principles by which cryptocurrencies were allegedly invented, or at least the blockchain, shall we say. Well, there we go. We should mention that there's a new issue of the magazine that's just come out. It's got the very eye-catching headline, Uber Killer, and it's about Didi Chuxing. This is the Chinese version of Uber, which is, I think, the world's most valuable startup. It's got a crazy valuation.
$56
billion. $56 billion. But it's not just interesting because it's hugely valuable. It's interesting because of the principles on which it operates and that you've probably never heard of it. And there's a lot of these companies in China that we in the West tend to think are just copycats of Uber and Twitter and Facebook and Instagram or whatever it may be. But it turns out if you actually take the time to get to know them and interrogate their business models and the people working for them a little bit more, you see that there's an awful lot of nuance here. So we did some really, really interesting reporting, even if we do say so ourselves, in China. So we've got a report on Didi Chuxing explaining why this is a company that you really need to know about, and also a general essay about China moving away from this copycat business model and really taking on the West at its own game and winning. It's a really, really fascinating insight into something that we're going to be reading an awful lot more about over the coming years as China becomes more and more of a force to be reckoned with than it already is. Recommend that you pick it up. There's also bits and bobs of it that we're putting online throughout the month if you can't get your hands on a print publication. But the print publication is a beautiful thing. So if you can, please do go out and buy it. And we will see you again next week. Thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.